The city is meant to be not only a place for political success, as important as that is, but also, and first and foremost, of spiritual success. Jerusalem is intended to draw the world to it, not through empire, but through serving as a Jewish spiritual beacon. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 13, Solomon's Dangerous Diplomacy. I am Meir Soloveitchik. For the greatest part of humanity and the longest periods of history, empire has been the typical mode of government. Empires have no interest in operating within an international system. They aspire to be the international system. So Henry Kissinger writes in his very interesting book, Diplomacy. It is a comment that allows us to analyze the reign of Solomon, the only period in Jewish history when Jerusalem sat at the center of an empire. Solomon's goal was bold, to become the international system, to create a state of affairs in which all the world would come to know of the God who dwelled in Jerusalem. And yet, the statecraft pursued by the man known as Jerusalem's wisest monarch, the man who spiritually sanctified the city forever, was flawed. And fascinatingly, it is upon reading not only the Bible, but also the history of ancient Egypt, that we can more fully understand Solomon's mistake and also comprehend what Jerusalem is truly meant to be. David dies, and following his father's advice, the young Solomon begins his reign by executing those who had challenged Davidic authority. Thus, the Bible's first description of the Solomonic monarchy is succinct, and the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon. But the verse that follows immediately after, toward the beginning of the book of Kings, is astounding. And Solomon made affinity with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and took Pharaoh's daughter, and brought her into the city of David, until he had made an end of building his own house, and the house of the Lord, and the wall of Jerusalem round about. These are gobsmacking, astonishing words with which to begin Solomon's reign. The first royal marriage is a diplomatic one, to a pagan princess, to a daughter of Egypt, a country whose ways Israel is warned in the Bible to never imitate. What is going on here? This is often thought to be a marriage engaged in to ensure the balance of power, but that is incorrect. Solomon, as we said, seeks not to work within an international system, but rather to become the system. And an Egypt that would send one of its own princesses to a foreign kingdom is a weakened Egypt, an Egypt suddenly devoid of empire. And if Solomon seeks an affinity with Egypt, it is because he sees an opportunity to extend hegemony over his neighbors, and especially over the ruler, who until recently had been the supreme power in the Near East, Pharaoh. The Bible does not identify which pharaoh was Solomon's father-in-law, but Egyptologists do. And we must say a bit about what was occurring within the realm of Israel's neighbor and erstwhile ally. The identification of this Egyptian monarch, of whom the Bible speaks, is assisted by another biblical verse, which describes the city on the borders of ancient Israel granted by the pharaoh as part of his daughter's dowry. For Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and taken Gezer and burnt it with fire and slain the Canaanites that dwelt in the city, and given it for a present unto his daughter, Solomon's wife. The Egyptologist Toby Wilkinson, in his outstanding book, The Rise and Fall of Ancient Egypt, describes this Egyptian event as, quote, a final humiliation in its dealings with its former imperial possessions in the Near East, end quote. And based on a fragmentary Egyptian relief, Wilkinson identifies this pharaonic conqueror of Gezer as Siamun, who reigned toward the end of the 21st dynasty, from 970 to 950 BCE. Wilkinson notes further how this very marriage and the fact that a pharaoh willingly gave away a conquest to his neighbor illustrates how far Egypt had fallen. Or as he puts it, quote, in the prosecution of new kingdom diplomacy, the pharaoh had frequently taken other kings' daughters in marriage to cement strategic alliances, but he would never have agreed to an Egyptian princess being used in this way. Now, in the 10th century, Egypt had to face the uncomfortable truth. A house divided, it was no longer a force to be reckoned with, merely another bit player in the febrile world of Near Eastern power politics, end quote. Thus, Solomon sees opportunity in this weakness, and his betrothal to the daughter of Pharaoh is not merely a marriage for preserving the balance of power. He seeks hegemony, and the marriage to the daughter of Pharaoh will be followed by betrothals to princesses from every neighboring nation. And there is a higher purpose to his plan, one which can be discerned in the next diplomatic step, described in chapter 5 of the first book of Kings. Solomon sends a message to the king of Tyre to the north, saying, "And behold, I intend to build a house for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord spoke unto David my father, saying, Thy son, whom I will set upon thy throne in thy room, he shall build a house unto my name. Now therefore command thou that they hew me cedar trees out of Lebanon, and my servants shall be with thy servants. And unto thee I will give the hire for thy servants according to all that thou shalt appoint. For thou knowest that there is not among us any so skilled at hewing timber like the Sidonians." Solomon thus seeks an alliance with Hiram of Tyre, a nation known as Sidon in the Bible, in building the house of God. To this request, the king of Tyre responds reverently. "And it came to pass when Hiram heard the words of Solomon that he rejoiced greatly and said, Blessed be the Lord this day, which hath given unto David a wise son over this great people." The temple will be built in concert with Tyre, and it is meant to serve as a source of inspiration not only for Israel, but also for other countries, just as the arrangement inspires Hiram and draws him to the God of Jerusalem. Similarly, Solomon's many marriages were intended to serve as spokes to a wheel, connecting the neighboring nations to the very same God of Jerusalem. But there is a tremendous irony in Solomon's plan, one which we can discover by turning back to Egyptian history. The Pharaoh at this moment was not Egyptian, but Libyan, and the 21st Egyptian dynasty illustrates how the once mighty empire had brought outsiders into the kingdom that captured it from within. Wilkinson tells us that during the Ramesside period, quote, "the Egyptian military had a long and proud tradition of employing foreign mercenaries and had therefore proved a natural and popular career choice for many Libyan settlers." And he adds that by 1069, Libyans in Egypt had not only achieved high office, they stood ready to assume the government itself, end quote. And Wilkinson further writes that, quote, "for the next 400 years, Egypt was dominated by Libyan power brokers, a dramatic twist of fate that had a profound effect on society." And that, quote, "with such a strong sense of their own identity, generations of inhabitants of the Western Delta regarded themselves as Libyans, not Egyptians, a phenomenon still prevalent enough to be remarked upon by the Greek historian Herodotus 5 centuries later," end quote. Yet, even as all this was going on, Solomon brings pagans into Jerusalem and creates an empire from Jerusalem, utterly confident that Jerusalem will change these countries, never seeming to worry about the possibility of these countries changing Jerusalem. Thus, from the very beginning of his reign, an agonizing irony hovers over Solomon's kingdom. Immediately after forming his alliance with Pharaoh, Solomon asked the Almighty for wisdom. "Give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between good and bad." God is pleased with this request, and according to the Bible responds, "Behold, I have done according to thy words. Lo, I have given thee a wise and understanding heart, so that there was none like thee before thee, neither after thee shall any arise like unto thee." Solomon seeks wisdom to inspire Israel and the world. And at first, it seems as if his dreams will be realized. I cite several verses from the biblical description. "And Solomon reigned over all kingdoms, from the river unto the land of the Philistines and unto the border of Egypt. They brought presents and served Solomon all the days of his life. For he had dominion over all the region on this side of the river, from Tiphsah even to Aza, over all the kings on this side of the river, and he had peace on all sides round about him. And Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the east country and all the wisdom of Egypt. And there came of all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon from all kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom." Solomon's mind thus analyzed every aspect of the world and, at least initially, was also made manifest in his ability to dominate the world. But analytic understanding is not biblical statecraft. The former is a result of reflection, and if mistakes are made, the stakes are not high, but the consequences of a mistake made by the biblical king of Jerusalem can be terrible indeed. Henry Kissinger further notes in his book that, quote, "the analyst runs no risk. If his conclusions prove wrong, he can write another treatise. The statesman is permitted only one guess. His mistakes are irretrievable. The analyst has available to him all the facts. He will be judged on his intellectual power. The statesman must act on assessments that cannot be proved at the time that he is making them," end quote. This is profoundly true, and precisely because of the uncertainty involved in statecraft, The Bible gives the Israelite king several ironclad rules, which are stated explicitly in Deuteronomy. He shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart be not turned away. Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. These rules against marrying too many wives, against coming too close to ancient Egypt, against accruing too many horses, against accruing exorbitant funds through excessive taxation, these are laws that are ultimately meant to prevent the king of Israel from fashioning an empire. Empire requires cavalry. Empire requires extensive funds. An ancient empire requires diplomatic marriages. All these Deuteronomic laws Solomon violated, overlooking the fact that if Jerusalem was at the heart of an empire, then its spiritual and moral mission would become endangered. According to rabbinic tradition, Solomon assumed that the Deuteronomic rules did not apply to someone like him because his own wisdom would save him from mistakes. But in truth, the Torah's commandments were meant precisely for someone like him. And ultimately, as we will see, in making Israel the heart of an international empire, Solomon will achieve the opposite of his aims when the first diplomatic move he makes upon ascending the throne is an omen of what is to come. Paganism will enter the heart of Jerusalem itself. Thus, a central theme in Jerusalem's history emerges again. The city is meant to be not only a place for political success, as important as that is, but also, and first and foremost, of spiritual success. Jerusalem is intended to draw the world to it, not through empire, but through serving as a Jewish spiritual beacon. Kissinger, in his book, cites an anecdote that upon learning of the death of Cardinal Richelieu, who essentially controlled France, Pope Urban VIII is supposed to have quipped, "If there is a God, Cardinal de Richelieu will have much to answer for. If not, well, he had a successful life." The point, if we may analyze it out of context, is that all too often, what seems to be successful statesmanship can be done in defiance of certain spiritual rules. The Bible tends to place on a pedestal those leaders that combine political success with a looming religious vision that defines it, especially those that make that vision manifest in Jerusalem. And for Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, this is precisely why the land of Israel is where it is. He writes that the Holy Land, quote, is and has always been a key strategic location where three continents, Europe, Africa, and Asia, meet. Lacking the extended, flat, and fertile spaces of the Nile Delta or the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, or today the oil fields of Arabia, it could never be the base of an empire. But because of its location, it was always sought after by empires. So it was politically vulnerable. It was and is ecologically vulnerable because its water resources are dependent on rain, and rains in the region are always unpredictable, hence the frequent famines mentioned in Genesis. Its existence could never, therefore, be taken for granted. Time and again, its people, surviving challenges, would experience this as a miracle. Small geographically and demographically, it would depend on outstanding achievement, political, military, and economic, on the part of its people. This would depend, in turn, on their morale and sense of mission. And Rabbi Sacks adds, there is a directness, a naturalness of Jewish experience in Israel that can be found nowhere else. History tells us that the project of constructing a society under divine sovereignty in a vulnerable land is the highest of high-risk strategies. Yet, across 40 centuries, Jews knew that the risk was worth taking. For only in Israel is God so close that you can feel him in the sun and wind, sense him just beyond the hills, hear him in the inflections of everyday speech, breathe his presence in the early morning air, and live dangerously and confidently under the shadow of his wings. End quote. This is also true, and there is a reason for this profound sense of the divine presence, and it has everything to do with Jerusalem. Which is why Solomon, according to the Jewish tradition at the end of his life, will reflect the lesson he has learned, opening and closing one of his biblical books with the following. The words of Ecclesiastes, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. In the end, if Jewish tradition will still praise Solomon, it is because it is not empire but the building of the temple that will be his truest achievement, one which will endow Jerusalem with an enduring sanctity, capturing forever the unique relationship between the Almighty and the Jewish people, and which will create a city that serves as a spiritual beacon for the Jewish people and for the world to this very day. This is Mayor Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.